Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Michigan Literary Network Radio for Wednesday, October 5th, 2016. I'm Andrea Daniel, and today we're returning to a previously aired interview with Amy Hamrill, author of Detroit Hustle. So let us get right into that segment. And here's a little bit about Amy Hamrill. Her bread and butter is covering small business in Detroit, the country's greatest city for innovation, entrepreneurship, and community building. She came prepared with her own pair of Carhartt bibs, every grease stain earned in service to her father's excavating company. She also knows a fair amount about urban renewal and rural poverty. She is currently an adjunct professor of journalism at Michigan State University, but she once bled blue as a Knight Wallace Fellow, class of 13, at the University of Michigan. She is an alum of Crane's Detroit Business, CNN Money, Fortune, Small Business, Westward, and USAA, where she helped military families make smarter choices about their money. She also has a background in enterprise and investigative reporting. One of her proudest accomplishments was helping start the Jackson Free Press in Mississippi. And I would like to welcome Ms. Amy Hamrill to Michigan Literary Network Radio. Amy, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. Thank you for accepting the invitation. And I have so many questions here. This is such an interesting story you have. And I understand that you and your husband bought an abandoned home in Detroit and had it renovated. First question, where did you and your husband move from?
My husband and I, we moved from Brooklyn, New York, though he's originally from Tennessee and I'm from Colorado. So we have no connections here. We just fell in love with the city, but we moved originally from Brooklyn.
Wow. Okay. You fell in love with the city. That's a wonderful thing to hear. But here's a question I imagine that you get often. Why move to Detroit of all places in the world?
You know, it's a complicated and simple one. The very simple answer was we were sold on the idea of the cheap real estate. The more complicated answer is, you know, New York is a wonderful place. We both loved it there. I don't think either of us ever imagined leaving, but with rents rising to the point where it was becoming more and more difficult just to stay in the middle class, a lot of our friends were being priced out of the neighborhood we loved. We started thinking about where we could go, where we could have the opportunity to maybe start a business or do something creative or not just sort of have to work 100 hours a week just to make the rent. We started looking around the country, and I thought about New Orleans, but even though Carl is from the South, it's too hot for him, and I didn't want to go back west where I was from, and Seattle and Portland just felt like cities that sort of already had an identity, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't sort of a place where you could come and be a part of what was there and thinking about the future, and we always kept coming back to Detroit, and I'd been to the city once, maybe a decade earlier on vacation, and it just sort of started creeping into me at that point, and it sort of became this idea of something else. But of course, like everybody who's coming to Detroit, it's this idea of it, right, rather than the reality on the ground, and you get here, and it's both completely the same and completely different, and you realize and both how amazing the people and generous and warm and welcoming they are, how hard the city works, and how much work there is still to be done. But you're also suddenly, I don't know, I was taken aback by how much love and passion everybody here had for their city, because it's so contrary to what we heard about in other places, that Detroit was broken and that there was something wrong with this place and nobody wanted to be here. And all of a sudden we found this community of amazing, beautiful people who loved their city and wanted new people to come, but wanted them to come and also love it and be a part of what it is. So it was very complicated, sort of finding this place and where we were going to go. But when we also found Detroit, there was also nowhere else I could imagine being.
Wow. So talk about some of the things. I mean, you mentioned the people, the hardworking, how hard the city works and the love and the passion that the residents here have. But talk about some of those things that you encountered upon that you encountered once you moved here and started the renovation process of your home, because that's where a lot of your experience comes from.
So, I mean, once we got here, we bought the house. It kind of came to us through serendipity, which is very Detroit. It wasn't on the market. We happened to meet a woman who heard that that I was going to be starting my job at Cranes and that we were looking to buy a house in the city. And she said, hey, my brother-in-law has a place across from him that has been, that is interested in possibly being sold. Let me put you in contact. And so she put me in touch with her brother-in-law, who put me in touch with the sellers, who turned out to be living 15 minutes outside of my hometown of Golden, Colorado. And so, which is just crazy. Like, I would come all this way around the world to wind up trying to buy a house for people 15 minutes away. But they had bought the house off of a Florida slumlord, who'd let it see, it had some tenants in it, just let it run into disrepair. It had been empty for quite a while. The neighbors struggled to keep it boarded up and keep them lawn mowed, and just been a real problem. So this couple in Colorado finally got it off of this landlord and paid all the back taxes, and thought they were going to be able to relocate here, and were not able to get their job transfers, so they had to sell it. So we bought it from them. And like everybody, I think, who comes in at first, naive, we thought $35,000 for a 3,000-square-foot house, this is amazing, it's so cheap. And it is, right? Mm-hmm. But the cost of purchase is not the issue here. The acquisition isn't the problem. It's the cost of renovation. And there's not a lot of money in the market for renovating these houses. And when they've been allowed to go into such disrepair over such a long period of time, it doesn't matter if you live in Detroit or Denver or San Diego or New York, the cost of renovations are about the same, plus or minus 10%. Materials cost what materials cost, and so does labor.
Mm-hmm.
And so this house was about a $400,000 rehab, though we couldn't have imagined that at the time. Whether you live in Denver or Detroit, the difference is in another city, it would appraise for what you could put into it. But here in Detroit, the banks are used to houses selling for so low, for so long, for foreclosures, that when we first bought it and we told the banks what we were trying to do, they basically laughed at us and said, well, I'm sorry, we can't write you any kind of a loan because we don't think this house would be worth more than $100,000 when it's done. So that's a complication that the city's experiencing, is a lot of interest in these cheap homes. A lot of people willing to move to the city, but fundamentally because the appraisal values are too low, it's hard for people to get the money to be able to do it. So it becomes sort of an all-cash process, which really limits who can do it. And my husband and I were only lucky enough. I mean, we sort of went down the path not really understanding this, and at a certain point you either figure it out or you don't. So we just kept going. But I grew up in a trailer in rural Colorado. I don't come from wealth. My husband's middle class Tennessee, and so luckily he had a 401k, but we had to break into our 401k, completely spend all of our retirement savings, which, as a personal finance editor, God bless, I know how fortunate we were to have any kind of retirement savings compared to most of the country. I mean, that's sort of a serious privilege in and of itself, but we had to break into that. And then my parents divorced, and they had to sell their small business, and my dad loaned me his proceeds from that divorce so that we could be able to do the construction. So with the idea that hopefully when it was all done, we could convince a bank that it was worth the money we'd put in and get some kind of loan at that point to pay people off. But my dad just sort of believed in me, and we believed in Detroit and marched finally down the path. So I'd say that's the big thing in terms of Detroit that I can speak about, is the real estate here is both very interesting, and everybody knows how cheap it is, but the renovation costs are something that the mayors working on, city council, philanthropists, foundations, everybody's trying to figure out how to solve this problem. Everybody's aware of it, but solutions aren't easy.
Right, and what you mentioned about the real estate, and then the other end of it, what you just described to us, is the thing that people don't hear about. That's not what's being touted when you see these signs, move to Detroit. They don't tell you the rest of the story.
Right. And so I'm hoping my book will help people understand how worthwhile it is. But, as a journalist, I always say, I think one of the things that's interesting is people like binary. They either like to be a hater or a booster. And I think can support Detroit and really boost it by being really honest about what's going on, whether that's telling the story about where Detroit is now, because I see people come to the city having read in the New York Times or wherever about all these great tech startups and all of this new
mm-hmm.
energy, and they get here and they're like, wait, where is it? And it's like, well, it's here, but it may not look like what you're used to, or it's been told in such big, you know, broad strokes that it seems like we're further along than we are. With the real estate, it's
mm-hmm.
the same thing. Let's talk about, yes, real estate's cheap, but there's, you know, limits to financing, so people can come in and be able to be successful in it rather than being set up to fail. I don't think talking about some of these things is often perceived as hating on Detroit, and I see it as setting people up to succeed rather than to fail.
Right, right. What was it about the experience, and maybe it was the whole of the experience, but what was it that particularly sparked your memoir, Detroit Hustle? Was it the whole of it, or were there certain parts that said, hey, this is my life, and I want to talk about it?
Actually, so it started as, after we bought the house, I started a blog just to try to keep friends and family from around the country, you know, up to date of what was going on, because it was getting difficult to try to talk to everybody on the phone. It was, you know, too many phone calls
mm-hmm.
a week. And so that started. And then I started getting people asking questions about how to do something in Detroit, or I would have a question. And I thought, well, I don't know how you buy a house for cash. I couldn't find anything.
Mm.
Like, you just show up with a suitcase and be like, here's $35,000 in singles. Well, what do you do? And the answer is no. You go through a title company, and there's a process. But there was no repository for some of this information. So part of my blog became trying to answer some of those questions in hopes that other people doing this would be able to find answers.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was doing that, I pitched a book to my agent, and I pitched a book about what was going on in Detroit, because I felt like a lot of the books that had come out at that point in time, and this was 2012, 2013, were looking back at what had happened to Detroit and weren't necessarily
mm-hmm.
sensing what was going on in Detroit and the sort of shift of, you know, what could be future and possible. And so I pitched a nonfiction book about Detroit with sort of a through line about the house to keep it interesting. And
mm-hmm.
Running Press bought my book, and my editor said, I really want it to be a memoir. Because she said what she thought people would be interested in was what it's like for a person to actually live in this city, more than sort of a journalistic account, a real sort of personal
mm-hmm.
account of life in a bankrupt city. And so that's how it became a memoir.
So when she suggested the memoir, how did you feel about that suggestion?
It was mixed. The first reaction was, you know, a little bit of terror of, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
wow, putting it out there that boldly, that's, you know, that's scary, especially as a journalist who's used to having sort of that a little bit of distance between myself and the reader.
Mm-hmm.
I report other people's
mm-hmm.
stories.
Right.
But then I thought about where some of my biggest successes have been as a writer, and I thought it's when I've been able to take something personal and use it to tell a bigger story from it. Like, I've been audited by the IRS in the past, and so being able to write a story about what it's like to go through an audit so people can understand and feel that, but then also write the story about what's going on, the IRS changing rules, things like that, to be able to take the personal and make it global is sort of always great. And I thought, wow, that's a really interesting thing to try to tackle with this. But my editor kept pushing me and saying, the question people are going to have is, why does a girl from rural Colorado move to Detroit? Like, what's that connection? And I had to do a lot of writing to figure that out, because it's not immediately obvious. And so that a lot of the memoir is sort of coming to terms with who I am and my background and sort of rural middle, you know, rural poverty to, you know, lower middle class, and then my family slide back down into poverty. And while I kind of go up the class ladder into, you know, middle class, and I'm doing this great house in Detroit with my husband, and meanwhile my mom and dad are divorcing, and my, you know, brother's having to move in with, you know, my father with his babies, like life in my family back home isn't easy. And so a lot of the book is dealing with the issues of race and class, and what the issues of home, you know, what makes home and community in the modern context.
Wow. Okay. So with all of that said, I think now would be a good time for you to read an excerpt from the book.
Well, I would love to. Thank you. And actually, I was debating on two sections, but based on what we just talked about, I'm going to read the one about maybe, you know, some of my Detroit, Colorado connections. So let me, thank you. So Detroit smells like home. The warm sweetness of prairie grasses baking in the summer sun transports me back to the fields behind my grandparents' house. The almost licentious smell of the earth after an evening rainstorm is that of freshly irrigated crops. The intoxicating scent of honeysuckle vines climbing up chain link fences and corrugated metal walls recalls the construction sites and scrapyards of my childhood. Rich wood smoke curling through Detroit's sharp winter skies is the smell of safety of my mother. Grease, dirt, and sweat mixed together to create the same musky scent of work that was always caught in my dad's Carhartts. The smells of my past mingle with my future, overlapping and intertwining like a jazz standard, so that Detroit seems inevitable now, as if I'd been searching for this place since before I knew I was looking. My hometown of Fruita is a place that feels like it's 1,000 miles from nowhere. It sits at the back door to Colorado, nestled in the Grand Valley, boxed in by gray shale cliffs to the north and red rock canyons to the south. The snow-capped Rocky Mountains rise in the distant eastern sky while the great Utah desert encroaches from the west. My mother describes it as a lunar landscape, when she's being generous. But there is great beauty in its harshness. Fruita, like Detroit, is not an easy or obvious place to love. They do not inspire poetry and serenades on first meeting. They are places that unfold slowly and whisper their secrets. It is the way the moonlight catches a rock face or the majesty of a pheasant taking flight at dawn, Detroit's Art Deco skyline in the distance. There is a hardship writ everywhere in both of my spiritual homes, and they are connected, for me, across space and time by the scents and the sound of the meadowlark's song on the wind.
Wow, what lovely language that was. Amy Hamwell reading an excerpt from her book, Detroit Hustle, here on Michigan Literary Network Radio. That is such, that's lovely, just lovely language. And I want to ask you, Amy, a little bit about you as a writer. And it's a real simple question. Why are you a writer?
You know, it's actually still hard to think of myself as a writer. it is. When I was in elementary school, I was actually really good at math. I remember having to write a book in like the third or fourth grade. And the teacher saying to me, it's good that you're good at math because, you know, English is not your strength. You can't do this. And if there's anything you should know, like anybody tells me I can't do something, I will go and like make damn sure I can. So I didn't really intend to become a writer. As much as I became an editor first, so I went in high school, I wound up getting involved with the student newspaper and was the editor there. You know, in college, I was, on student government and did some editing. My first job out of college, I was the editor-in-chief of a chain of business journals. So most of my career I actually spent as an editor as a way to avoid being a writer, but still a journalist. Because what I loved about journalism was being able to, like, speak truth to power, speak to for the voiceless, sort of like a real mission. As I tell my students at Michigan State, journalists are supposed to be the good, the truth, and the light. That's our job. And I could be the editor because writing was too scary. And it's only, I would say, in the last 5 to 7 years that I've started finding any confidence in myself as a writer. So even having this book feels a little bit weird. Seemed really great writing it when it was just me in my head. And now that it's actually like running around the universe free, I'm like, oh, that's a terrible idea. People are going to read that. What was I thinking?
Right.
But I'm coming to terms with the idea that I am a writer and that I have something to say and that I have a voice. And I'm excited. A lot of the books about Detroit have mostly been by men, so I think it's interesting that I'm going to get to have a memoir out by a woman, that maybe that brings a different voice to the conversation. I would love to see some writers of color get their opportunity to bring their voice to this conversation. Detroit is, as we know, is a predominantly black city. I think it's 87%, and yet none of the books out there are by African-American men or women. And so I think, you know, one of the things I want to do as a writer is, I guess it's still the editor in me, is figuring out how to promote others and try to promote more voices. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I think of myself as a writer. I do think of myself as an editor and sort of being able to figure out how to curate that. And I hope that my story helps do that for other writers, that they'll, that maybe this will open doors or the interest that they can get their stories told.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned, you know, you're the lone woman who's writing about Detroit. But there is an African-American young man, gentleman, Aaron Foley. He released his book last year about
that's
Detroit,
true.
How to Live in Detroit Without Being a Jackass.
In December.
So that's
absolutely
yeah,
true.
That's,
I forget. Aaron and I are friends, too, and I forgot. That's right.
Yeah.
Because I've been writing this for so long without – and Aaron and I writing our books simultaneously,
right.
But now we're both out. I think that in my head is both of us not actually being published yet. But Aaron's book is so funny. It's super, you know, wonderful. I recommend it to everybody. I've got I do Airbnb in my house sometimes, so I have it in the guest bedroom. So that and Angela Flournoy's Turner House. So two beautiful voices.
Right. Excellent. So other than the birth of your memoir, has being a resident of Detroit shifted your writing focus in any way?
I mean, when I was here, I was mostly writing when I was at Crane's Detroit Business, I was writing about entrepreneurship and small business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's always been sort of the heart of who I am, with my father being a small business owner, having grown up around it. So I don't think Detroit has necessarily changed it, but it has refined it in that when I'm writing for national publications, I've become a writer who tends to focus on underrepresented populations. So when I'm writing for Fortune about entrepreneurship, somehow not by, you know, by design, I tend to write about businesses owned by, you know, minorities and women. And again, not because that's where the path I was going to. I never set out to just write about women, but somehow those stories keep compelling me. And the women of Detroit are so powerful and so remarkable that I keep meeting them and thinking, oh my gosh, I have to tell this story. So I think that's how Detroit has shifted me as a writer. It's just given me this great material of these really amazing people doing amazing things, sometimes against all odds. And oftentimes it's women, or I find that their stories aren't the ones getting elevated. So I try to take that opportunity to do so when I can.
Okay. That's wonderful. That is a wonderful statement about your focus being refined rather than necessarily changed or shifted. That's a wonderful way to put it. As a first-time author, you've been a writer. You know, you juggled writing and editing for a while, and I saw all of the editing opportunities that you've had on your website. You have your resume so nicely up there on your website, which is amiehamerl.com, and that's H-A-I-M-E-R-L. But as an author for the first time, are there any things that you've learned about the business of being an author?
Yes. yes, definitely about the business of being an author. So I read Anne Lamott's book, Bird by Bird, a lot over the years, and it really took hold while I was trying to write Detroit Hustle because, I mean, Anne Lamott talks about the shitty first draft and just sitting down and doing the work, and I feel like I understood that intellectually, and now I understand it as just part of the work, that, yes, you just have to get up every day and put those words on paper. Paperation doesn't come on command. You have to create a regimen and a rhythm for it to happen. And when I would do the work, you know, actually getting up in the morning on a schedule and, like, walking the dog on Belle Isle, coming home and getting my coffee, writing in my journal, you know, doing a little bit of journaling, and then just sitting down at the same time every day and just putting those words on paper, I could guarantee that something good was going to come. Maybe it would come at word 300, maybe at word 1500, but I had to create that discipline. And that's what I tell everybody, is I thought that writing a book was a lot like writing an article for me, which is, you know, I can spend a couple hours interviewing and a couple hours writing, come back, do a little revision, and I'm done. The narrative structure is pretty easy. But with the book, I thought it was always a joke that people said, oh, no, I didn't really know what the book was about until I was through it. How can you not know what the book is about? I felt like you had to have a full outline, know what it was, but I did not know what this book was about or how it would potentially end until I was in the process of writing it. And I've had to come to terms with that being okay, that you sit down, you do the work, you put the words on page, and you have to allow your brain the space to be creative and the synapses to create those connections you wouldn't have seen otherwise until you just started writing and letting that come out. The other thing I learned is just how important it is to just sort of surround yourself with interesting people and interesting ideas so that your brain has the potential to make those connections when you're sitting down and writing, and that's not just sort of social time, but taking that time to be around and have interesting conversations is just as much a part of the work of being an author and writing a book as sort of coming up with the idea, that you've got to create that constant fodder in your brain for new ideas and new connections. Otherwise, you won't have anything interesting to say. And I hope I've had something interesting to say.
Right. Oh gosh, that is such good stuff right there. I've taken notes. I'm gonna take it down and I'm gonna put it out there. So those are wonderful things to say. And I know that you're one of two ladies featured at an event this Friday on the 12th. Tell us about that event.
I'm so excited. I am doing an event with Angela Flournoy, who was just shortlisted for the Penn Award and, you know, this amazing new voice, first-time author herself. Her book, The Turner House, came out last year. And we're going to be talking at a coffee discussion panel for the Detroit Women's Leadership Network. We're going to be talking about what it's like to be women authors and sort of issues of women and leadership and what women have done for us or not done for us along the path. I don't know Angela's take or story on it, but I'm excited to get to have this conversation with her because women have been so very powerful in my life, and just somehow the right mentor turning up at the right point in time and being able to look back and say, wow, how lucky did I get that in each of those like pivotal moments, this right mentor who just by happenstance were women, you know, opened themselves up, whether it was the woman who helped me find the house or my first mentor, Donna Ladd, who sort of got me my first job and set me on this path. Without my first mentor, I would not be where I am now. Like I said, I was a young girl from a trailer in rural Colorado. The idea that I would ever have a book or be living in this great house in Detroit, that was not the life that was ever destined for me. So it's been the power of women, you know, including my mother, to sort of set me on this path.
And that was the interview with Amy Hamrill, author of Detroit Hustle. And when that interview was done and when it came out, Detroit Hustle had not been released. That was earlier this year, around early spring. But it has been out for several months now. And you can check her out at amyhamrill.com. And that's amyhamrill.com. And before we close out the show, I have to let you know about a few upcoming events in Detroit. Tomorrow, Thursday, October 6th, Pages Bookshop presents Katie Chase, author of Man and Wife Stories, and Matthew Fogarty, author of Maybe Mermaids and Robots Are Lonely, Stories and a Novella. Katie Chase and Matthew Fogarty are two former Detroiters and Write a House finalists. This event is at 6 p.m. and Pages is located at 19560 Grand River. And on Friday, October 7th, poet Beautiful Thought celebrates her first Friday's Open Mic Poetry Series one-year anniversary at Detroit Vintage. The featured poet for the celebration event is none other than Rosemary One Single Rose Wilson. The event is from 5:30 to 9:30, and Detroit Vintage, a wonderful coffee and tea house, it's actually one of my favorites in the city, it's at 10335 West 8 Mile Road. And on Saturday, October 8th, the Motown Writers Network hosts its second Saturday monthly meetup. Our guest this month is Kevin Wayne Johnson. The meetup is from 10 a.m. to noon at the Detroit Main Library, 5201 Woodward, and we're up on the third floor in the old Fine Arts Room. And that's it for this edition of Michigan Literary Network Radio. Stay connected with Michigan's literary community through the Michigan Literary Network and Motown Writers Network at MotownWriters.com, and you can find us on Facebook. And be sure to tune in to Michigan Literary Network Radio on BlogTalkRadio.com next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 to hear more literary good stuff. And I am Andrea Daniel for Michigan Literary Network Radio. Thank you out there for listening in, and I'll be back with you next Wednesday.